We are continuing on with John chapter 11 this morning. And start in verse 47. Read verses 47 and 48. Therefore, the chief priest and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So we've got a closed meeting here by the Sanhedrin and the chief priests and the Pharisees. And what we see here, as well as in the context, that they're really driven by self-interest on their part. And they're acknowledging the undeniable impact of Jesus and his teaching with the people. And it's ironic because a little bit later in chapter 12, verse 19, they admit, the Pharisees said to one another, "You see that you are not accomplishing anything. Look, the world has gone after him." So it didn't take long for them to recognize their failure. Doesn't mean that they're not going to try to still do something about it, but they're at least acknowledging, okay, we better hurry up and do something about this guy. So the reluctant admission, if you will, by Christ's enemies also really serves as a confirmation that he really was doing miracles. Because, you know, if there was any shred of evidence that he didn't do miracles, then they would have brought that out, to protect their own self-interest. But they didn't do that. They admitted here that he was doing miracles. So the fact that even his staunchest opponents there couldn't deny his wonders really, highlights the reality of those miracles. Back in chapter 10 of John, Christ replied to them. He says, "I showed you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you stoning me?" So there was lots of back and forth between Christ and his opponents about the miracles that he was doing. Really puts them in quite a dilemma. They couldn't deny it, much like after Christ ascended back to heaven, the apostles, when they were doing the miracles, the leadership at the time recognized that these were unlearned men, but that they had also been with Christ. So as much as they wanted to deny it, stop it, put a halt to it, they really couldn't do much about that. They could stop the people, the apostles and Christ, but they couldn't stop God's work. That was going to continue despite their best efforts. And really the miracles that Jesus performed, they were acts of compassion, benevolence, well-known and visible to all of the people around him. Why would you stop someone that was doing that? It really points back to them as individuals, the leadership, of why is it that they had such a problem with that? He never did anything to harm someone. He never did anything against, the establishment, whether it be, the Romans. He never did anything like that. But they were still obviously against him, which really points back again to their motives. So in their conspiracy here, their leaders not only rejected the Holy One and Righteous One, but also the one who was selflessly serving mankind. He was doing what he could to help others. And in the opposite line of that, how much were the Pharisees and the Sadducees really out trying to help the people like what Christ was doing? From his ministry on the earth, but even after his ascension, that work continued from a moral and spiritual transformation across the world. And it can be considered even more miraculous than what the physical healings that Christ was doing. Because it says in John 14, 12, Christ tells them, truly, truly, I say to you, the one who believes in me, the works that I do, he'll do also, and greater works than these. So the work was going to continue on. In spite of all of the of mankind's staunchest objections and everything that they could try to do to stop it, God's will is going to be done. Now, in verse 48, when he says, the rulers there say, if we let him go on like this, all the people will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take over our place and our nation. So in that verse there, when you really look at it, the chief priests and the Pharisees, they reveal really the truth about human nature itself. Human nature, okay? The selfishness and that selfishness can really blind our moral compass, if you will, our moral vision. If there had really, like I said, if there was really any credible accusations that Christ had not performed these miracles, then they would have used those. So they're really not approaching it. They couldn't deny it, so they were going to do what they could to stop him in any way possible. They couldn't find fault with his character at all. So his enemies really viewed his ministry solely on through the lens, their own lens, of how it might affect their power and their status. That's pretty clear here. They were self-centered. That was their perspective. They weren't really caring about the people. They were caring about themselves, which, unfortunately, when leadership has that power to do that, then things go awry pretty quickly. So they fear really the potential and the political repercussions of Christ's growing influence amongst the people. And they really did not want Roman intervention at all, because that could jeopardize their authority and their autonomy as a nation. Because one of the things about that particular time, and particularly in Judea, in the what we know of as Palestine today, that was ruled by the Jews. They were ruled by the Jews. The Romans, even though they had control of the area, allowed them to pretty much rule on their own. They still wanted their taxes, and they still wanted order, okay? And the order was really the thing that drove the Jews a lot, the hierarchy. Because if Christ, if his followers had an uprising, then what that would be, in their view, it would be perceived by the Romans as a rebellion. And then the Romans are going to come in, and they're going to put a stop to it. Obviously destroy a lot of people. The temple would probably be put to ruins, and they would no longer have the autonomy, which means that they would not have the power and the influence over the people. So that's the groundswell that they were afraid of Jesus's ministry, that he was, well, obviously getting a little bit too popular for their taste. And then again, like say, what it could lead to. You know, Jesus's background was what really kind of scared him a little bit as well. He was a humble background, obviously, carpenter. He had no political power. But they chose to, oppose him through deceit and violence, because they couldn't come at him from any other direction. We see in the news today, there's all kind of political squabbles going on. And different methods are used to attack the other. But Jesus didn't wield any political power. He didn't have that, and he didn't have a strong family hierarchy where they were wealthy and influential. So they couldn't attack him in that direction. So the only thing that they could do is through deceit, deception, and that's hence the reason why they met silently, privately here to try to put a stop to his ministry. So, you know, despite all of that, you know, Jesus, his approach, he didn't possess the background, the political strength or the family strength. He had God's strength behind him. All right, so I want to move along to verse 49. This is an interesting passage here, one of the statements that are made. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." Does anybody here remember who was the preacher that did this sermon in Bousman, Ed Bousman, in Ohio? "You know nothing at all." You were there, I'm sure. You remember it? He went on and on, but that's... And this is the verse that he used. He took off on this verse. But anyway, Caiaphas says, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and the whole nation not perish." Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. You know, in those verses there, the Pharisees and the priests, they begin the plot against Jesus to kill him because they were afraid of his influence and the potential threat to their own power. But there was a real fundamental misunderstanding on their part of really their perception of who Jesus really was. They didn't really obviously understand. They thought that he wanted to establish some sort of earthly, visible kingdom and one that might challenge the Roman authority. And that misunderstanding is really what fed their hatred towards him. Now, it is true, obviously, that Jesus spoke about a kingdom, but it was not a kingdom here on earth, but a kingdom of heaven, a spiritual realm, not at all a political one. And, you know, if the leadership would have understood that, they might have avoided a lot of, a huge catastrophe. So, you know, unlike earthly rulers who seek power, Jesus did want to rule, but he wanted to rule the hearts and be able to guide the souls towards righteousness. You know, a goal that there was no earthly power that could ever be able to accomplish that. And ironically, you know, the plan to eliminate Jesus as a political threat was both a success and a failure. They did manage to remove Jesus. This, you know, that solved their immediate fears anyway. But their actions ultimately led to the downfall that they were afraid of, because Rome eventually did come in. It did destroy Jerusalem. It did level the temple. So it really, in a sense, illustrates the foolishness of thinking that even if we can manipulate current events, it cannot guarantee the desired success that we're shooting for. You know, we can do a lot of things, but God's will is still going to be done. So Caiaphas, his counsel here is an illustration of how personal ambition and political strategy can intersect with divine prophecy in unexpected ways. They were doing what they thought, you know, they had control of doing, but it was all working right according to God's plan. They were working to their own downfall, thinking that they were going to succeed. Anybody here ever remember the children's books, Burr Rabbit in the Briar Patch? It's an outlawed book, by the way, now, for racist overtones. But it teaches a lot of things about, Burr Rabbit, don't throw me in that briar patch, don't throw me in that briar patch. It's exactly what he wanted, it's a great story, and it kind of parallels, the story here, that as much as the Pharisees, Sadducees, wanted their way, it's actually the way God wanted it. It was going to happen. Interesting book. If you can get a hold of one, hold on to it, because you probably can't buy them anymore. So the council here, they were politically appointed. The Sadducees were politically appointed as a high priest. Now the Pharisees were a little different. They were more along the rigid biblical Old Testament sense, but the Sadducees, they were more on the political side. They were the ones that were intermediaries, if you will, between the Roman Empire and the people. So their approach was more matter of fact, okay, viewing it more as a political convenience rather than any spirituality that might have interfered with some of their desires. So unbeknownst to Caiaphas here, his counsel aligned with God's redemptive plan for humanity. Like I said, he was doing exactly what God wanted him to do, not to his knowledge or his going along with it. Because we know that in 1 Peter 3:18, I'll read it to you, Peter explains that for Christ also suffered for the sins once for all time, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God. So it was the plan all along that Christ would suffer so that he could bring us to God. And we wouldn't, without him suffering and dying, that sacrificial, vicarious death for us, then we wouldn't exist now. There would be no rationale, no reason for it. The scope of Jesus' mission extended beyond just Israel. It was going to include all of mankind, as the verse. Now, Caiaphas didn't recognize that, but when John continues on, now he did not say this on his own initiative. He prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for in verse 52, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. Caiaphas would have never gone along with that. The Gentiles were the furthest thing from his ideas. His was purely selfish interest, and certainly didn't include the Gentiles. And that was the mystery that Caiaphas, couldn't foresee. So even though Caiaphas here recognized Jesus' popularity and his moral integrity, he was morally pure, he argued from a purely selfish standpoint. He says there, this is what I want to deal with. It is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish. Who remembers Commander Spock? In Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, he's about ready to die, and he speaks through this plexiglass shield or glass shield to Captain Kirk. He says, the needs of the many outweigh the rights of the few, or the one. Which is basically what Caiaphas is saying. The needs of the many outweigh the rights of the one. There's actually a term for that, and I'm going to deal with it here a little bit. And the term is called a utilitarian idea, where the greater good for the many should take precedence over the interest or the rights of the individual or small groups. So, you know, that's obviously what Spock basically said. But kind of looking at that, you know, concept from a historical perspective, has this ever occurred? Has this ever happened? You know, has it ever been used? So the concept, basically, it's an idealistic framework, and it was developed by thinkers back in the 18th and 19th century, and I use that term thinkers loosely, okay? Utilitarianism suggests that the morally right action is the one that maximizes overall happiness or well-being for the greatest number of the people. Sounds like democracy, doesn't it? Democracy in the true sense, not what we live in. Well, okay, I won't go there. But it's that's really what democracy is. The greatest number, whatever the greatest number of people, whatever the good for the greatest number, is morally correct. So under this view, if sacrificing the well-being or rights of a few individuals could bring greater benefits to the majority, such a sacrifice might be considered justifiable. But when we stretch that, when we look at it, it really gets into some important moral and ethical questions. And those questions regarding the individual rights of the person that's being mostly affected by it. All right, so has this ever happened? Yes. The Japanese American internment at the very beginning of World War II. So during World War II, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, we know that that's what started us into it anyway, the U.S. government forcibly relocated and interred over 100,000 Japanese Americans, most of which were U.S. citizens. The fear was that they might act as saboteurs or spies for Japan. So the U.S. government argued that the safety and security of the many, the American people, outweighed the rights of the few, the Japanese Americans. So that decision was based on utilitarian rationale. And it was, you know, to prevent potential threats, and it resulted in a violation of the civil liberties of over 100,000 people. And then decades later, and I didn't realize this, it was widely criticized, and then in 1988, the U.S. government issued a formal apology and provided reparations to surviving internees, acknowledging that the internment was based on racial prejudice rather than actual security threats. Another one, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Towards the end of World War II, the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, civilian cities, not military. Civilians, okay, killed hundreds of thousands of people. The stated goal of that event was to force Japan to surrender quickly, thus ending the war and preventing further loss of life, particularly among American troops. All right? So the U.S. leadership there, they determined that sacrificing the lives of the many civilians in Japan was necessary to save the lives of countless soldiers and civilians on both sides who would have died if the war had dragged on. The needs of the many, okay, ending the war, saving more lives overall, was seen as outweighing the rights and lives of the individuals in the cities affected. That decision is still debated today, you know, whether that was right, wrong. Some argue that it saved lives by bringing a swift end to the war, and others contend that it represented a moral atrocity. In the news lately, how often do we hear about a few civilians getting killed by a war that's raging in the Middle East? And it's in the front page of all the newspapers. Three civilians were killed. It's like, yeah, three civilians were killed. That's unfortunate. That's not good. But we bombed 100,000 civilians. 100,000. I'm not saying it was right or wrong, because you know there's valid reasons for both sides of that argument. Now there's a third one, the Nuremberg trials after the end of World War II. Nazi war criminals were put on trial for crimes against humanity, including the Holocaust. And so many of the defendants, the people that were put on trial, argue that they were following orders for the greater good of their nation. The Nazi regime justified its actions, including genocide of the Jews and others, by claiming that it was the better good for the people of the German people. They believed that the needs of the nation outweighed the rights of the minority groups that they deemed undesirable. So that twisted application of that idea of the greater good is an example, really, sometimes of how the reasoning can be abused and twisted, and it leads to moral atrocities that people can occur, that they can incur based on their understanding, their justification. You know, isn't that what people tend to do when they do something wrong? They want to justify it. Yeah, it's the woman you gave me. So the Nuremberg trials really rejected that defense. They affirmed that there was that there is a universal human right that cannot be violated, even in the name of the better good. So they recognized that, they saw through that argument. So the dangers of that concept that Caiaphas brought out here, you know, while the idea of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few can be seen as a noble principle when applied correctly, but it carries inherent dangers in it. And that is, as I mentioned a moment ago, the violation of the individual human rights. They're not individual human, likes. They're rights, that we have. That when this ideology is applied too rigidly, the concept can lead to justifying major injustices against the individual or minority groups of who it's mainly affecting. Okay. And morally, deciding whose needs are most that matter, that can really become a very slippery slope, can it? If those in power are the ones who decide who is expendable for their greater good, it can lead to an abuse of power and obviously moral corruption that goes along with it. So the misapplication of that principle, you know, the example of the Japanese-American internment or the Nuremberg defense shows how easily the idea can be manipulated for selfish, nationalistic, or even evil purposes when they're not tempered with a strong moral fabric. If the person or persons making the decisions aren't morally astute, or even moral, then it can go sideways really fast. So when Caiaphas suggested that it was better for one man to die for the people than for the whole nation to perish, he didn't know that he was prophesying the true purpose of Jesus' mission, which was to sacrifice himself for the salvation of everyone else. So what we see in this passage here in John 11 is we see a behind-the-curtain glimpse of the Jewish leaders plotting and scheming for their own selfish motives and justifying it through something that is entirely selfish. It sounds good. I mean, it does sound good, you know, on the surface. It's better that the majority benefit, but what about the minority that's affected? In this case, Christ, that goes unnoticed, or you know what? It's better for most people, as Caiaphas said. So all the while, God knows the hearts and minds of man. When the apostles asked Jesus to help them learn how to pray, one of the parts of his prayer in Matthew 6 is, "His will be done on earth as it is in heaven." You know, we can plot, we can scheme, and we can do everything that we can to make sure that that we get what we want. But in the end, God's will is going to be done, and none of the scheming and maneuvering on our part is going to make any difference. So we're glad that God is the one that is in charge, and that we are part of His plan. We are part of keeping that kingdom growing and healthy, and certainly extending that invitation to all of those that we come into contact with. So, appreciate your attention this morning.